Greetings to each one of you in Jesus' name this morning. You may open your Bibles to John chapter 10 for a message. A number of years ago, there at Lighthouse School, the old one, I'm not even sure how the plan came together, but I'm sure David remembers the day that we decided to have a picnic or something, and everybody was supposed to bring a quart or a gallon of chili, and I built a fire in the parking lot, and as people came to school that morning, I had this big kettle, and they just would dump their chili into it, and after a while, we just had this huge kettle, and for most of the morning, I had an interesting but relaxing morning of sitting on my lawn chair and stirring the soup to keep it from cooking fast, and every now and then I'd sneak a taste of it because you really didn't know what you were going to taste. I mean, you mix so much stuff together. And after a while, I thought, well, it could use a little more black pepper. And I would, nobody's looking, I'd put some in. But the real flavor of that soup, that chili, was never known until we served it out. And that sort of reminds me of the sermon I have here this morning. It's a lot of things been stirring and I look at my notes and they don't even seem like they're in order, but it is a message that springs out of an event that happened last Sunday morning. Some of you know the story of Brother Ernest going to pick up his friend for church and finding him dead at the kitchen table, and that set off a series of events in my life and some of my brother's lives of tending to the dead, because unfortunately, there wasn't anybody else to do it. And it's become a very sad and heavy story to me to look at the reality of a person who could be on the face of this earth with the life that God gave him for 89 years. And when he departs, you struggle to find somebody to take care of what's left. I'd like to start reading at John chapter 9, verse 39, and I want to look at the parable of the Good Shepherd. And Jesus said, "For judgment I am come into this world, that they which see not might see, and that they which see might be made blind. And some of the Pharisees which were with him heard these words, and said unto him, Are we blind also? Jesus said unto them, If ye were blind, ye should have no sin. But now ye say, We see, therefore your sin remaineth. Verily, verily, I say unto you, He that entereth not by the door into the sheepfold, but climbeth up some other way, the same is a thief and a robber. But he that entereth in by the door is the shepherd of the sheep. To him the porter openeth, and the sheep hear his voice, and he calleth his own sheep by name, and leadeth them out. And when he putteth forth his own sheep, he goeth before them, and the sheep follow him, for they know his voice. And a stranger will they not follow, but will flee from him, for they know not the voice of strangers. This parable spake Jesus unto them, but they understood not what things they were which he spake unto them. Then Jesus said unto them, Again, verily, verily, I say unto you, I am the door of the sheep. All that ever came before me are thieves and robbers, but the sheep did not hear them. I am the door. By me, if any man enter in, he shall be saved, and shall go in and out, and find pasture. The thief cometh not for to steal, and to kill, and to destroy. I am come that they might have life, and that they might have it more abundantly. I am the good shepherd, and the good shepherd giveth his life for the sheep." I think I'll stop reading there. The phrase of the verse that keeps coming back to me as I think about the story that I was starting out with is here in this passage. But before we dig down into that and stir the soup, as it were, let's just back up and see what's going on here. What's going on here is that Jesus is telling a parable, which he did a lot. And he tells these stories. I suppose you could say they're made up stories. They're true to life stories. That's a parable, but they're not something that actually happened. It's a coined story, made to illustrate the point or the reality or the truth of what is going on right now. Okay, And he's telling this parable about sheep, about a shepherd, and about a sheepfold. And the purpose of this story is to teach the truth about us, himself, and the kingdom of heaven. Sheep, shepherd, sheepfold, us, himself, kingdom of heaven. And he was talking to real people. This was not something that he went into his office or his study or went out underneath the apple tree and wrote on a scroll and mailed it to an editor to be printed. But it was a real-life conversation. He was telling people and talking. He was interacting with them. And I started the passage in John chapter 9 so that you could see what I never saw before until I just started looking at this and realizing that this was not some impromptu, as they were walking over to Bethany one day, he started thinking that this crowd could benefit by a parable about sheep. It is actually the resolution. It is his final comments about the story of a man born blind and a group of Pharisees that refused to acknowledge that he was the shepherd who made the blind man to see him. I never saw that before. Until I was reading in another version that takes the chapters out, and I was like, oh, where does chapter 10 start? Well, I don't think it matters. It's all part of chapter 9 and the story. And so he gives this parable in verse 6. He makes it clear that it's up to the readers, it's up to the listeners to get the point. And not everybody does. Not everybody did in this story, and not everybody gets it today, even when they listen to the parable today. But my bigger question as I read through this is, why don't people get it? Is there something, strange language? Does he use big words that you can't understand? Why can't people get it? Was it on too high of a level? Was it only, okay, he was talking to Pharisees, so maybe his language was too elevated. We know better than that. Let's just look at this parable a little bit, and I'll give you a couple overview points of that I believe it's trying to make. Point number one is Jesus is using his I am teaching mode. This is common in the book of John. There's at least 7 times, and if you do across all the writings of the Apostle of John, including Revelation, you would get 13. Because Revelation says things like, I am the resurrection. No. I am Alpha and Omega. I am the first and the last. And it's more of the same. It is, one writer said, an outrageous claim of divinity that humanity can barely understand. For when Jesus says something like, I am the door, he's actually doing something that humans ought not really to do. He is doing something that politicians will do, where they will say, if you want this and if you want this, I'm your man. And most of those, if not all of those, get to the office they are elected and find out they can't do what they said they would, no matter how hard they want to. They can't do it. And it is inhuman to talk like this. Only divinity can talk like this, where you say, I am the door. I am the bread of life. I am the first and last. I am the light of the world. I am the good shepherd. There's 13 of them in all if you just start reading through the New Testament. And they are not outrageous because he is Jesus. They are simply true. He can back everything up, he says, with his life and death and resurrection. I am the resurrection and life. Watch me. And they did, and they saw, and they worshiped, because he said, I am, and he was, and he still is. I am the door, he says in this parable, 2 times. And he's not saying, he's not saying, I am one of many doors. I'm a door that's a good option for you. I am the best door. I am a door. He's just simply saying, I am the door. And if you wanted to just draw it out, it would look like this. Old world sheepfold. We're looking down from the top, and this is a wall. A And there's only one place to get inside that wall, inside of here. And it's right here. And there's a door there. And that door's name in the parable is Jesus. One place. Now, what he says in the parable is that humans are strange, weird, stubborn. There's something. And they will actually try to go in there some other way. And on a Sunday, on a beautiful fall Sunday morning, it cannot be explained why you would do that. There is no logical reason why you would come up to a fold like that, that has this impassable wall on it, and there's a door, and anybody can go through that door anytime they want. All they have to do is ask and try, and in they can go. But people will say, I'm going to go check that corner. I think if I put one hand on this corner and the other hand on the other corner, I can go up across. And it can't be explained why. And yet it's still happening today. When I was a child, I remember an old record we had and had this song on. I Googled it and I found it. It was written in the 1960s. There's only one door to heaven. Jesus fixed it that way. The rich and the poor will go in the same door, for Jesus fixed it that way. Straight is the gate and narrow the pathway, and few shall travel this way. This road leads home, and you're welcome to come. He'll guide every step you take. And the chorus says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. I hear Jesus say, if you want to go, you'll have to go in by him, because there is no other way. Is that hard to comprehend? Is that math that a first grader can't understand? It's so strange, but it's so true, and it's exactly what he was teaching. So, all the other seven I ams are the same way. Bread of life, I am the way, the truth, or life. There is. When Jesus said in John 14, I am the way, the truth, and life, you know what he said after that? He said, no man cometh to the Father but by me. Simple. No other way. Now, second overview of this parable that I want to point out is that it says that in the parable that Jesus is not only the door, he's the shepherd, and he holds the welfare of the sheep to be his highest priority. You cannot ignore the ever-present truth in as you read through the parable, as you listen to him speak, that he is a good shepherd, a good one. He calls them by name. And you're right, Leo. If you can call them by name, that's a good place to be. You know how it is. You're in the crowd, and you come by, and there's somebody you've met, and they call you by name, and you say, oh, he remembers me. I guess we have more of a relationship than I thought. And this is the pleasure of every last sheep, is what the shepherd says in the parable. He moves, he stands at the door, and as they come through, he calls them by name. They don't have to introduce themselves, for he made them, he knew when the day they were born. And here they come, and he calls them by name, and they're inside. And he comes inside, and he calls them by name, and their name is never forgotten. You know that I can't even remember all your names at council meeting. They just, boom, they're gone. Well, this is not the shepherd. He calls them by name. And just by the fact that he calls them by name, we know that he loves. And he's acquainted. There's something deeply personal here. And it stands on its own merit. He also says about the welfare of the sheep in verse 3, that he call his own sheep by name, and he leadeth them out. Do you think the sheep are ever tempted as they're going back out the door with the shepherd to say, hey, where are we going? We used to do this when I was a child. Sunday afternoons, we would, I guess we outgrew this, but we would do something like this. we would be done with Sunday lunch, and the children would say to our parents, let's go do something. Well, they wanted to take naps, but we wanted to go do something. So after a bit, Dad would say, all right, get in the car, let's go. And he said, well, where are we going? Wait and see. And he wouldn't tell us, and we just head on down the road. And those were the days when you could drive around Sunday afternoon and just look if somebody's home. And if they were, you stopped in. And sort of, come on, Dad, tell her, where are you going? Wait and see. Well, we get, you know, up to the crossroad and we turn right. Ah, we're going out toward Riceville. Oh, now, and then the guessing would start. And after a bit, we pull into Uncle Melvin's and everybody was tickled because we went somewhere good. But he wouldn't tell us. But we learned to trust our dad that when he played that game, it was going to be all right. And this is the story of the shepherd. He calleth them by name, and he leadeth them out. And we're all Abrahams. We really don't know where we're going. But we can learn to be okay with that because we've learned that the shepherd will always lead us well. He leadeth them out. And you just see this fantastic care that goes on between the sheep and the shepherd. He says he putteth them forth in I didn't write it down. I remember the line. I know in verse 9 it says that they go in and out and they find pasture. And that's a good pasture. There's no varmints out there that are going to tear the little ones. There's no poisonous plants there that are going to destroy them. But he puts them out, and you see that. And then you see in verse 10 that the shepherd has this confession that he makes. And he says, well, you know, there's some shepherds that if trouble comes, they'll flee. And I just want my sheep to know that that'll never happen when I'm leading and you're in the flock. I just want you to know that I will die for you before I forsake you. And I'm come that they might have life and that they might have it abundantly. And the whole doctrine of salvation is wrapped up in one or two lines here. But we know what it's talking about. I am come that they might have life. He loves us. The shepherd is good. Verse 11, I am the good shepherd, and the good shepherd giveth his life. We have a duty upon us, those of us who have become Christians, those of us who follow Jesus, those of us who are in the fold have a duty to help the rest of the world outside understand that they have been died for. That's what communion was partly about the last couple weeks that I've been traveling to churches. We came here. And just that reflection that I've been died for. And we let that sink down into our soul and become food for our days. That I will live for him, for he died for me. And we have a duty to carry that message forward. Well, these are some of the things that Jesus is teaching in this parable. But he's teaching one more thing. He makes this statement, and this is the one that I just keep coming back to. He says in his parable that there are those, number three, who reject or interfere with the operations of the sheepfold. And he explains it this way. Verily, verily, I say unto you, he that entereth not by the door into the sheepfold, but climbeth up some other way. And that those three words, some other way, some other way, some other way, are the words that have burned in my consciousness all week long, as I sat with other men, and we told stories, and we said, well, this is what we saw in this life, and they said, no, it wasn't like that, it was like this, and then we would say, but then it was like this, and when the conversations were finished, there was just this cold realization that a good many of us had been duped. We have no evidence that the man ever went through the door. None. And it's hard to fathom. It is hard to fathom how a person could be born into, preached unto, and lived, and willingly went back under the preaching and the teaching and the interaction for almost 90 years. But by all appearances, never went through the door. And just dealing with that reality that within my own circle of awareness are sheep that are still trying to get over the wall some other way has been something that's just been burning in my consciousness. And one of the things Joyce and I talked about is how do you wrestle with this and still be respectful to the departed? That's part of what I grapple with right now. How do you look at this reality and see the shock of what has happened and still have a worthwhile respect for the departed? Jesus says, I'm the door, and there are people that says, we don't need this door, we don't want this door, there's got to be another way, I have another way, I'll do it myself. Now, I put a lot of words in somebody's mouth right there, but it seems to me that's kind of how it works. It's this inner decision that I will do it myself. And what I'm learning is that some of that do it by myself and that climbing up my other way can lay itself alongside of the valid entering in so closely that while you're watching it, you're not sure if you should even call it for what it is, because you might be wrong. When it's over, it gets a little more clear. Strangers call to the sheep. They're trying to get the sheep back out of the fold. He talks about that in verse 5. A stranger will they not follow, but they flee from him. There's just distance. But there's still these people that are trying to mess the fold up by calling, strangers calling. He says in verse 10 that thieves come to steal and to kill. And then there's these hirelings that are supposed to be the caregivers, and they're not the true thing. They're not a Jesus that is a perfect shepherd. They flee when trouble comes. Let's go back to Jesus' statement, I am the door, but sometimes people try some other way. And let's just think about what this looks like and try to learn from it. I told you already that John chapter 10 is an extension of John chapter 9. And I do believe that. It reads so cleanly. And so I have to believe that when you look at verse 6, where he's saying that he gave this parable for people to understand, and you look at verse 40, where Pharisees are standing there, and they are raising the question, and they're trying to justify themselves, that there is some connection between the charge of some other way and the people that he was talking to. And it seems reasonable when you read the whole story of John chapter 9 and the terrible conflict that an innocent man suffered by simply being healed by Jesus and having to defend it and having to explain it and then facing excommunication because he did not give them the answer that pleased them. And then Jesus sort of wraps that all up by saying, well, I'll tell you a story about some sheep, a sheepfold, and a shepherd. And I want to tell you that there are some that are going to try to go in the fold, try to manipulate the fold, try to operate the fold some other way. The illustration of the Pharisees of climbing up some other way is a vivid one, and it's a practical one. It is the illustration of people that would follow the law but reject the lawgiver. And that is not so hard for us to do. That can still happen in this dispensation. That is within any of our reaches, to follow the law but reject or ignore or disenfranchise from the lawgiver. And the normal reaction when we see that happening is to react to the law and say, oh, the law is terrible. But the abuse of the law does not make it any more immoral than it was before. It still stands for what it is, and it is to be respected, and the lawgiver most of all. What are the ways that we go some other way? I've been thinking about that, and I'll try to give you some of that in a little while. But let's just move on, where Jesus makes the observation that when you have somebody that is going to go up over the side, or he's going to try and get in over some other way. They didn't have hang gliders back then, and so you couldn't parachute in or fly over with an airplane and drop in or take your helicopter. I don't know all the ways that those people standing there thought about a sheepfold and somebody coming in another way. But he says that they are thieves and robbers when they do that. Now, a little bit of study about those two words was profitable for me. The first thing I learned is that these terms, thief and robber, that he uses here and a little bit later in chapter 10, are only used one other time in the Bible, the Greek word, that is. And those Greek words are, one time there was a thief and his name was Judas. The word thief is used other way, translated in English, but it's not from that Greek word. It just simply means one who takes without permission. Okay? And if somebody climbs over the wall, or they try to, they are taking without permission. So Jesus says. And Judas was a thief. He took money without permission. He had some drives and some desires that were without permission. The word robber is used one other place, and that is to describe the substitute for Jesus. No, it's one for whom Jesus substituted. His name was Barabbas, and Barabbas was a robber. And that means one who plunders. Now, a thief and a robber are the same person, except for one kind of big difference, and that is a thief takes without permission, a robber plunders. And the difference that happens is this, simply this, and that is, it is entirely possible that someone steals from you and you don't even know it. I am pretty sure that in 30-some years of public works, some of the tools that have disappeared off my truck, I don't actually have real camera footage to show you, but I am fairly certain that maintenance men and farmers were just happy to see it laying there on the shelf and it got slid back. I don't actually know that. I'm just telling you the world I live in, that's entirely possible. But my point is that it's just, oh my, where's the 10-inch channel locks? I had a Phillips screwdriver in this bag. Maybe I left it lay. I mean, we need to be reasonable about these things. But all I'm telling you is that it is possible to take away and the person is none to the worse when it happens. But when you start talking about plundering, that's a different story. When the robber leaves, things are never going to be the same again. And this is the kind of thing, like a story in Central America where the missionaries are robbed and the wedding pictures are stolen and they're gone. These people had something taken away from them that cannot be given back. And Jesus is saying that people that refuse to go in by the door but formulate their own plan and drive their own bargain end up taking away from people, and they may or may not ever miss it, but they also end up being people that take things away and it can never be restored, and the people know they are put by the worse for having it happen to them. And I don't fully understand why Jesus used those descriptions to talk about somebody that's playing games or faking it or being a hypocrite or falling short of the true entering in. Except that you can about see it if you know any stories of somebody that tried for a lifetime to enter in. You can also begin to realize stories of what happens when a person acts like they are entering in but was trying to do it some other way. Then it makes sense. This could be done by people In our church age, it could be done with something as simple as people who will attend a church but will never be part of it. And I don't know what the percentages are in the present day church as opposed to 50 or 100 or 200 years ago. But it's at the place, where, as far as I know, pretty much every church group has these people around the fold. I don't know what else to say. But they just will not. Just went on a service call this week, and a man from work asked if I know him. I said, nope, never heard of him before. He said, well, he lives over there in that valley, and he said he goes to that church, but he said He was excommunicated probably 40 or 50 years ago and never did another thing. There he sits. And when I got there, by all appearances, he should have been part of that church because he sure looked like he fit there. But he's not. He's not in through the door at all. And he defends himself, and people will do this. And I think about that. What Jesus was promoting here, what he was teaching, was something that requires simplicity, but great humility. Apparently, with our fallenness, there is a humility required to go through that door that is not comfortable to all of us. Apparently, that's how it works. We just think. I remember, I think it was C.S. Lewis who once talked about that there would be many more Christians in the faith if we could just outline a proper plan of what all we must do to get there. I'm not sure if that's who it was or not, but it's that thought. Give me an obstacle course. Put me in, what do you call those rooms where you go in and you got to figure your way out? You're locked in there. Escape room. Put me in an escape room. Then I can find the Lord. I am the door. By me shall men go in and out. And all it takes is to simply say, "Hello, Jesus, may I come in?" And that is so hard because it's not enough for many of us. Did you know, though, that some other way is actually the hardest possible way? As I was meditating last night, I took Sean deer hunting, and I'm sitting down there, and I have my notes, and I'm thinking about it. And all of a sudden, I thought about this hill back here. Now, when you first got this place, there was a bank there, and those steps weren't there, but there was a play area up there, and to get up there, you had to figure out how to get up. And one day, I don't know who all gets credit for it. I know that Leo had his hands on it. They went to work, and they put them steps up. And now there's a way to go up. And the way Jesus tells us, it's actually sort of like now that the steps are there, Leo stands at the bottom and says, "Come here, I'll carry you up. I'll take you up. Want to go up there? You ought to go up there. Here, I'll take you up." And I would look at Leo and say, "You ain't carrying me up there. No way. I'll just get up myself." And I would just go back up here against the church. See, I forget where to point. I need to point that way. I would back up here against the church, and I would just take off running. Not the steps. There's another way. And I would just hit that bank, and I would whoosh right into all the briars. And, oh, my, I don't have enough of speed. And I would back up, and I would really take off running. And I would run, and I'd run, and I'd run. And whoom, and I got about a foot farther. Now, why didn't I use my machete? And so you don't even run this time. You just go there and you start hacking and chopping. And it just takes forever. And, you know, by lunchtime, you're about 3 feet up the bank. I back off. I know what I'll do. I'll get my bicycle. And I will start clear down in that church parking lot. And I will just pedal out of flying up around there. And I will just go. And the whole time, Leo's standing by the steps and said, "I'll carry you up." No. I can do this myself. This is actually very human. This is actually very, very common. I know what. Let's go over to the sawmill and let's get one. Let's go over to Keith. We'll get one of the mini bikes or the bikes or whatever you have. They got power. We can do this. After a while, you got Donald's, what is it, a Geo? And you're just four-wheel drive. And you're going to go up that bank. And you still don't get up. I got one more for you yet. Here's what you can do. Go up to Duncansville. They sell Sherpas up there. It's some big things that have four big wheels. You can almost climb up over a water dam with them. You can go out on ice, and if you fall through the ice, they will float. And you can go up on a bank, and I think they will crawl up, that I see in the literature, 60-degree angle. That should easy handle. It'll just crush the brush, and it'll go through. I'm telling you. The easiest way to get into the fold is still to let Leo take you up the steps. By me shall every man enter in. But there are people, and it is not hard to do. It's hard to get done. that will try and try and try to get up that bank while the door is open. And it's awful to watch. It's just tragic to watch. And it's possible for me to do. What are some of the ways that we try to go up that bank, that we try to climb over? Just watching the events of life, I would say that one of the ways that people try to do this would probably apply to some of those Pharisees, and that is to just simply use things like something like education or learning, where you just study and study and study. And you dig deep and you find another philosopher and you go back to another writer and you tear this thing apart. You know, I find it enjoyable to try to figure out what is it that makes me a man and what is it that makes the image of God? What really is the difference between me and a monkey? But do you actually know that you don't need to know that? You don't actually need to know that. I have a niece who has a Down syndrome, and it is impossible for her to figure things like that out. But what she can figure out is that Jesus saves. And she has accepted Jesus as her Savior in a simplicity that I rarely see. And I'm telling you that sometimes learning, knowledge, and education can be our worst enemy to simply going through the door. And we should never forget that. It is great to learn the rest of your life. Go for it. But the day that that pursuit and that acquiring become your entrance through the door, you're no longer getting over. And this happens to people. They get so smart, they can't figure out what to do with it anymore. And it's sad. And so faith in the shepherd and the door remains simple. Something like our traditions. I was thinking about some other way, and I thought about, last evening as I was sitting out there, I thought about the heritage that I have been given. Some of you know my parents, they were Mennonites. Some of you know my grandpa. You might remember when he preached in your church, he was a Mennonite. There's a lot of things that I would think that the choice I made to put my suit on this morning has something to do with what Grandpa taught my dad and my dad taught me. Okay? And there is so much strength in tradition, in wisdom, and righteous living passed down through the generations. But it is possible to try to use that very thing to go up the bank instead of the steps. And we need to keep that in the back of our minds. That's a risky one for a preacher to talk about, because you might hear me say, don't use traditions anymore. And I would be misspeaking if I told you that. Because me doing it like my father taught me to is a very righteous thing, unless it becomes the only thing. Yesterday, we had a wedding at Tyrone. Some of you were there. Jason, I thought, had a very practical and good message on married life. And he had 3 points. His first point of what his emphasis was on a marriage that helps the other partner to live a victorious Christian life. I don't think he could use quite those words, but that was what he was talking about. It's a situation where Joyce and I get married, and then because I'm married to her, she has a better success in her Christian experience because she's married to me and vice versa. And he had 3 points of what this is going to take. And the very first one he taught was called a selfless service. And he had a quote from the military of how a soldier looks at his duty to be a part of the whole. And what his mindset is, and he pulled that back and told the young couple, now, you can take this motto of selfless service and apply it to your own experience. And it's easy on your wedding day when everything's bubbly and snortsy and it's just as good as it gets. We're hopefully not going to get. But the day will come when Justin or April and both will have to make conscious decisions, I believe, right here. is where I shall serve instead of pursuing what I want. But you know, that truth comes right back in to the search for the salvation of our souls. And I don't know that a man can humble, or a woman can humble themselves to get in through the door without consciously understanding that I'm giving myself up. I think that is the primary reason why a soul will either go in through the door or some other place. It's like it's almost like a target where there's only one bullseye and everything else is a mess. That selfless service, I've been thinking about that. Because one of the factors that seems to run very tightly through people who try some other way is an incredible puffed-upness. I just made that word up. Pride. Vaunting about how they feel about themselves. And apparently, I should have known this before now, but apparently it's impossible to be proud and go through that door. I think that's the way it is. Well, Jesus taught a very simple truth. He had a very focused audience. And the point was, you either come in by me, the one who healed the blind man, or you don't get in. See, I went down through that whole list of all the ways you can try to go up the bank, but the truth is, in the story that I'm talking about, and boys, if you like Sherpas or motorcycles or fast bikes or machetes or whatever, you need to understand this. Nobody gets to the top. You either take the steps or you never get to the top. That's the way it is. That's what Jesus was teaching. You either go in by the door or you come. And so maybe that's where the robber is. Maybe the one who climbs up over the end, in the end, plunders himself. He's a thief and a robber. And we need not talk about all the people they take from. We simply ought to observe the tragedy of a person who tries to do it by himself, but he mostly plunders himself. I think we should just go in by the door. Let's kneel for prayer. Our Father, which art in heaven, we thank you for the Bible, which helps us to understand the reality of our days. We thank you for the teachings of Jesus that help us understand ourselves, our state, but also help us understand the opportunity we have to be more than we are and to go places we aren't. Thank you for the sheepfold. Thank you, Jesus, for being the door. Thank you for being the shepherd who gave his life for the people. Father, help us to see the seriousness of what you were teaching in John 10 and to apply it to our own experiences and then to simply, humbly, cheerfully, brokenly walk in through the door that you have provided. Help us to remember these things in Jesus' name. Amen.